The Vintage Gamer, show number 15, Ace of Aces.
This show is a member of Goblin, the gaming broadcast network, gbncom.com.
Welcome to The Vintage Gamer, the podcast that seeks out great games from an earlier era. I'm your host, Jim Van Verth. The Vintage Gamer is available via RSS or direct download at thevintagegamer.net. So, welcome to this week's show. It's going to be a short one because I'm in the midst of prepping for my whirlwind Great Lakes tour. A quick 13-hour jaunt up to Buffalo, and then over to Columbus for Origins. Yes, I know Columbus isn't on the Great Lakes, but Ohio is. Then back to Buffalo to rescue the kid, celebrate the 4th, and then finally, home. As mentioned, I will be participating in a panel at Origins. It is going to be at 2 p.m. on Saturday. I'm not sure where it will be, but it's listed under seminars, so look for it in your program book in that section. As far as the rest of the con, I'll be there mostly Friday and Saturday, and will probably be hanging out in either the dealer room or the open gaming room for much of the time. I may also be in the Puffer Belly area, as by tradition I have to get my butt kicked at least once by the train game fanatics. I will be trying to playtest a number of games, so I'll have some capsule reviews when I get back, and I might do some interviews depending on availability of the portable recorder. It's my wife's, and podcasting is kind of part of her job, so we'll see about that. Speaking of my wife and her podcasting, if you want to hear me do something more than just intone on about games, I've been reading for a story that she's been working on, a serial story, for her podcast, Geek Foo Action Grip. You can find that at www.geekfooactiongrip.com. Olivier, eat your heart out. Beyond that, not much else is new. I'll be right back with a short review of a quick game, or is it a quick review of a short game? Right after this.
Firepoint Media, in conjunction with DragonCon, America's largest multimedia popular arts convention, presents Podcasting Now and Beyond, a celebration of portable media programming bringing together the full spectrum of podcasters and their audience, from pros to first-timers, for a conference of information and entertainment. Join us for panels, seminars, workshops, and events culminating in the Parsec Awards, honoring podcasting excellence and speculative fiction. Visit our website at www.parsecawards.com to join us in podcasting history. Podcasting Now and Beyond, September 1st through 4th at the DragonCon Convention in Atlanta, Georgia. Your future to the power of beyond.
The game this week is Ace of Aces, and for clarity's sake, I'm not talking about the 1986 Accolade computer game. What I am talking about is a Game Book game that came out in 1980. Now, at that time, Microsoft hadn't even released Flight Simulator yet. Now, while the basic program had been first published in 1977 by a third party, they wouldn't license and produce their version until 1982. And while there were war games that would cover flight simulation, they usually took more than an hour to play, and was usually from a godlike perspective. You never felt like it was you in the cockpit. So into this void came the game Ace of Aces. It was designed by Al Leonardi, a former history teacher, and self-published in 1980 under the imprint of Nova Game Designs Incorporated. And until home computer flight simulators caught up, it was really the only way to get that in-the-seat feel for an aerial dogfight for many years. Unless, of course, you worked for the military. The concept behind Ace of Aces is pretty simple. It's a two-player game where each player is a World War I flying ace, either German or Allied. Each player gets a book for their side. On each page, there is a picture showing your view of the aircraft, looking at your opponent. So, if your opponent is behind you, you would see a drawing of the tail of your aircraft, with a plane representing your opponent drawn as well. Or if he were up front, you would see the nose of your aircraft and his plane, and probably some graphics showing that you are firing. That is, if he is directly in your sights. There are 223 pages in each book, and they match between the books. So the relative positions of the planes on, say, page 125 of your book will match the relative positions on your opponent's page 125, just from the point of view of his plane instead. Below each picture, there is a horizontal list of maneuvers you can do, a range from ones that you can do with slow speed to medium speed to fast speed. These are various types of turns and wing slips, and include such fun things as Immelmann turns and barrel rolls. In the original Handy Rotary series, there was also a maneuver you can do that takes advantage of the torque of the plane's rotary engine, allowing you a slow U-turn to the right. Basic play is very simple. First, you and your opponent secretly pick a maneuver. Under your choice, there's a page number listed. You tell your opponent the number under your choice, and he tells you the number under his. You flip through the book to the page number your opponent gave you, ignore the picture, and look up your maneuver again. He does the same. You both then flip to the page listed, and hey presto, you're both at a new relative location based on your two maneuvers. Now, one wrinkle is if there is a T on your page. In that case, you are tailing your opponent, and he must tell you if he's going to go to the left, right, or straight. The idea is that you can see their rudder and so can predict their movement. Within those restrictions, they can, of course, do any maneuver they want. So, for example, they could say they're going to go straight and then do an Immelmann turn. In the basic game, combat is just as simple. Each player starts with 6 hit points. If you end up on a page where your guns are blazing, then you do damage to your opponent. You can be at close, medium, or far range, depending on the relative size of the plane in your view. A shot at close range does 2 points of damage, medium range 1 point of damage, and far range 1/2 point of damage. The first person to shoot down the other wins the game. Well, unless the other player escapes. There is one special page, page 223. On this page, the two planes are too far away from each other and are lost. If you manage to get to this page, then you have a chance of escaping and avoiding further combat. If you get to this page unintentionally and want to continue combat, then both players can choose to go back to the default starting page, which, by the way, is page 170. And that's the basic game. Now, admittedly, there is a certain lack of realism here, in that the two airplanes are in the same 2D plane, if that makes any sense. There's no change in altitude. And also, 6 points of damage really doesn't convey the different ways you can shoot down a plane. For those who want more realism, there is the intermediate and advanced games. The intermediate game adds basic altitude management. You can climb and dive small amounts, and need to track your current altitude on a pilot's log. Certain maneuvers also force altitude changes. Some turns require a slight stall on the aircraft, so you must drop at least 100 feet in the air when you perform them. Another example of a maneuver that causes an altitude change is the Immelmann loop, which requires you to climb or dive a certain amount, depending on how you want to do the loop, either up or down. All of this is important because now your relative altitude can affect how much damage is done. Get too far above or below your opponent, and you're now at medium or even far range, even though the pictures show you as close. Also, you get a bonus if you're above your opponent. The idea is you're coming down out of the sun. How damage is handled is also different as well. Each plane has hit points for front, side, and tail, and has a fixed amount of ammo on board. When you have an opponent in your sights, you choose how much you will use to fire at them, from 1 to 6. The higher the number, the more damage you can do, but it's also more likely to jam. The highest numbers, 5 and 6, can also only be performed when you're flying straight for a while. In any case, you choose the amount you're firing, subtract it from your ammo count, and then roll a die. There are modifiers to the die roll based on distance and whether you're above your opponent, as I mentioned. You look the modified die roll up on a table and apply the result. So if you, say, end up doing 2 points of damage, you then look at the picture, and if the picture shows you shooting at your opponent's tail, then the tail takes 2 points of damage. The advanced game extends all of this further, adding more complexity to damage handling, with more detail on the hit points and targeted shots and critical hits, and different means of climbing and diving. And also there are more restrictions on the type of moves you can perform depending on your previous actions. For example, I believe, I don't have the books handy, unfortunately, you can't perform fancy maneuvers like a barrel roll unless you flew straight on the previous turn. That may not be quite correct, but you get the idea. The advanced game also adds the notion of you playing a particular historical ace of the period, such as Manfred von Richthofen, the Red Baron, or Eddie Rickenbacker, or even Hermann Goering. Scary. I believe, again, I don't have the books here, you can get certain special abilities depending on which ace you've chosen to portray. There were 4 editions of Ace of Aces. The Handy Rotary series came out first, and featured pictures of a Sopwith Camel and a Fokker DR1, perfect for simulating battles between Snoopy and the Red Baron. The Powerhouse series was next, and features a Spod 13 against a Fokker D8. The Powerhouse series also has slightly different maneuver choices, as befits the different planes. Then came the Flying Machine set, with an Erko DH2 and a Fokker E3. These planes are actually from earlier in the war and have very limited maneuvering ability. However, the Erko has some interesting properties in that its propeller is in the back and it has a flex mount machine gun up front, which allows for some very interesting shots at the German aircraft, so it can shoot out slightly out the side of the plane. Finally, there was the Balloon Busters edition, which had an Allied aircraft up against a German ground gunner. The plane's objective was to knock down German balloons, the gunner's objective to shoot down the plane. All of these books are interchangeable, so you can take the Erko with its more flexible firing direction and put it up against a Fokker DR1 with its greater speed and maneuverability. I'd still put money on the Fokker, though. I should probably point out that while the pictures feature the aircraft above, you can simulate other planes by using the various statistics found in the intermediate and advanced games. Each aircraft will have different fuel capacities, gun setups, etc. So you could do a Fokker D8 versus a de Havilland DH5, if you want, just by using the right stats. I don't have much to say on strategy other than to think like a dogfighter and try to predict where your opponent will be next turn, and make your move to try and come in behind them. I do want to note that the game was originally planned out on hex paper, with short, medium, and long distance being 1, 2, and 3 plus hexes away, respectively. If that helps you visualize the game a little better, then more power to you. Also, it's fun to notice the little patterns in the book. If you both announce low numbers, then you know that you're going to end up close to each other. If you both announce high numbers, then you know you're going to end up far away. It's amazing how well the books are planned out, and at some point I'm going to have to sit down and figure out how they did it. For this show, I sat down with my friend Mark over a couple lunches and played through a few games. I have the Handy Rotary and a cheap printing of the Flying Machines set. Mark has the Powerhouse series somewhere but couldn't find it, which is a shame. I'd like to try that one someday. With the basic rules, we tried the Handy Rotary set alone, then the Flying Machines, then the Fokker E3 from the Flying Machines set, versus the Sopwith Camel from the Handy Rotary set. It was pretty clear that the Fokker was outclassed in that matchup. I played the Sopwith, and once I sussed out his movement, I really didn't have much trouble chasing him down and taking him out. The one weirdness is that, on certain pages, he had me shooting at him, while I didn't have myself shooting. We did figure out this was due to the flex mount gun on the Erko, but since I was flying the Sopwith, I didn't actually have that option. All in all, this does seem like a good way to balance play between an expert and a beginner. You just give the expert the plane with the limited abilities. Our experience with the intermediate game, which we played the next day, was a little more mixed. While we thought it added something to the play, it didn't feel like it added enough to justify all the bookkeeping we were doing. Our final conclusion is that the intermediate game is fine as an introduction to the advanced game, but if you really want to add more detail, you might as well go for the advanced game and have it all. Otherwise, just stick with the beginner game. A few more notes on additions, and then I'll finish up here. If you're going to track this down on eBay or some other auction site, then you'll want to be careful about the cheaper editions of both Flying Machines and Balloon Buster. The original editions had slipcovers and nice leather-styled covers. The cheaper printings have no slipcase, and the books have paper covers. I have the cheap edition of Flying Machines, and I must say it's very annoying not having that slipcase. I don't really miss the nicer covers. On the other hand, I did pay only $15 for it, so it's really up to your priorities. If you like the system, there are some others in the series. First, there is a World War II game, Wing Leader, which features 1940s aircraft. And then there's Jet Eagles, which has modern aircraft like F-15 and MiGs. That one's a little odd, given that modern aircraft don't really dogfight within visual distance. Finally, there's the Star Wars Starfighter Battle Book, which has an X-Wing versus a TIE Fighter. That one came out almost 10 years before the PC game. Then there are a couple which aren't really dogfighting aircraft games. There's Bounty Hunter, which simulates a Western-style shootout. And Dragon Riders of Pern, where you're both riding dragons and hunting Thread during Threadfall. This is assuming you're familiar with the Pern series. Well, if you're not, read a book! I haven't played any of these, so I can't comment on the quality of them, but you can read more about them on Joseph Scolari's great Ace of Aces collector guide site. In summary, Ace of Aces is a great classic game and an unusual mechanic that you really don't see anymore. Well, yes, you can sit down with a modern flight simulator and get a more realistic picture of aerial dogfights. There's something charming and infinitely more portable about carrying around two books and having a quick dogfight with your buddy on the train, or sitting on the floor while waiting in line at a con, or just over lunch. If you can find an inexpensive copy, and there are some out there, give it a look. I'll be back with feedback on the Mule Show right after this.
Grasshopper, you have learned much in your training. However, to achieve ultimate geekness, you must pass one final test. You must snatch this chip from my hand, Grasshopper. I wasn't looking. You must snatch this chip from my hand. Once again, you must snatch this chip from my hand. You must snatch this chip. Enough!
Learn to be a true master. Visit GeekFooActionGrip.com.
I did get a fair amount of feedback on Mule, mostly correcting me on the Mountain Wampus. Rather than read it all, I'll just do one from Joey Kanya. Sorry if I screwed up your name, Joey. Which is more in-depth than the rest. Thank you for the great podcast and the greatest game ever created. I listened and remembered many of the great times I had playing this game. However, I do have to point a few things out. Number one, the Mountain Wampus could be caught without a mule as bait. The reward increased as the game went on. Number two, the different races had slight differences in either mining, the Bonzoid, or farming, the smiling Pac-Man looking guy whose name escapes me. And I'll just point out here that that guy is the Packer. One other handicap for the human was that they went through food very fast. Usually you could get a mule on two plots and still hit the pub. The human could only get one, two if they were very close, and you didn't go to the pub. Three, the price of a mule was twice the price at which the store would buy smith ore. I think it took two smith ore to produce one mule. Four, any attempt to put a mining mule on the river would result in a lost mule. Five, there are only a few layouts as far as the mountains' christite fields were placed. Played enough times, you could memorize where the christite was. 6. You had mentioned that the computer players were experts at resource management. I have to disagree somewhat. In the C64 version, the computer would overcompensate for shortages or prices. This would involve heavy mining of smith ore in the beginning, and then heavy christite mining later in the game. If there is a high price in a resource, the computer will remove and re-outfit mules to overproduce a resource, shrinking their reserves. This can be bad if you rely on their surplus or the resource that is no longer produced. Those are just my top-of-the-head thoughts. Oh, and thank you for putting the theme song at the end. I'm embarrassed to admit that as much as I loved the theme, it was a few beats into it before I recognized it. Thanks for all of that detail, Joey. I had trouble tracking any of that down. It was difficult to figure out in the few plays that we had. So I'm glad that you, and the rest of you fans out there, enjoyed the show despite my lack of experience with the game. By the way, my comments on the ability of the computer player were based on Danny's, or at the time Dan's, rather vague comments in the Atari manual. I guess I inferred a little too much from that. A few more notes on Mule while I'm at it. First of all, if you want to play the game legitimately, and I do strongly encourage that behavior wherever possible, do track down Space Horse. I took a quick look at the demo version, and it looks really good. Very nice graphics, and it supports four-player internet play. And it really is pretty much just Mule. Also, if you haven't gone to the website, I do want to point out that there have been some attempts at board game versions of the game. Check out Show 14's show notes for links to Kuehl and Llama. I'm not sure how well either will flow as a board game, as they both look like they're trying to simulate the game in all of its detail, at the expense of smooth play. But, hey, they're free, and they might help you meet that Mule Jones. And that's it for feedback this week. If you have feedback for the Vintage Gamer, on this show or any other, you can leave comments on the website, which is thevintagegamer.net. Or you can contact me directly via email at vintagejim@gmail.com or via Skype. My username is JV Square. Or you can try my new shiny voicemail number at 1-206-350-8684. That's 206-350-VNTG. Feedback is always welcome. And thus concludes yet another aerobatic episode of The Vintage Gamer. Our theme is performed by the trio Music of the Spheres, and available on the album of the same name at magnatune.com. Your humble host is Jim Van Verth. The next episode of The Vintage Gamer will be an Origins report. Until then, keep trying those new games, but don't forget to play the old ones. Thanks for listening.